Hello, welcome to this week's edition of the Africa Climate Conversations podcast, a weekly podcast bridging climate change communication gaps in Africa. I'm your host, Sophie Mbogwa. The 26th UN climate change meeting starts this weekend for the next 2 weeks in Glasgow, Scotland. So this week we thought it best to have the African group of negotiators bring us up to speed on the critical issues the continent will be pushing at Glasgow. So I'm honored to have the spokesperson, Obasanjo Saini Nafo. Thank you so much, Obasanjo Nafo, for finding time today. Welcome to the show and please introduce yourself.
I'm Saini Nafo. I'm an ambassador in Mali, high representative for climate change. I'm an advisor to the president at home. I'm also the spokesperson of the African group. I am a former chair a few years ago for the West African region. You know that every 2 years, a region chairs Africa. And right now, we have Gabon chairing the AGN. I've been involved in negotiations for about 10 years, mainly on finance, mitigation, and issues related to rules and procedures.
And also you do chair the Adaptation Initiative, right?
That's true. I'm also the technical coordinator of the African Adaptation Initiative, which was an initiative launched in Paris at COP21 in 2015 by African heads of state to really enhance adaptation on the ground. I'm very involved in that initiative, and we could really dedicate some time because that initiative deals with implementation on the ground, you know, whereas the negotiation deals with quite well, negotiating decisions and all kinds of negotiation matters. But this initiative deals really with enhancing implementation on the ground. So I'll be happy to present some of the work and activities underway.
Fantastic, because I plan on having some time before this building momentum on COP26 ends to discuss basically the initiative that were agreed upon during the Paris Agreement time, that is the Adaptation Initiative and also the Africa Renewable Energy Initiative. So we will have some time before the end of November to basically discuss where the Adaptation Initiative is, what we have achieved, and why it is very important, especially at this particular time, and adaptation being one of the crucial issues for the African group.
True. I'll be happy to I'll be happy to come and present, definitely.
Super. All right. So what I wanted us to talk about today is basically look back at what happened in Madrid for our audiences to bring them to date, what exactly happened in Madrid and where we are picking things from. I know they've been previously, there have been, of course, meetings that have happened, online meetings and different other meetings that have happened, even if COP26 was actually postponed to this year. But I just want you to bring us to speed. What happened for the African group? What did Africa achieve in Madrid? And what were the things that were left hanging?
Well, unfortunately, not much happened in Madrid. You would recall that in Madrid, we were supposed to finalize what is called the Paris rule book. The Paris rule book, which is it's basically all the technical work which is needed to fully operationalize the Paris Agreement, and so we are still we're still left with three very important negotiations to finish that. One is actually on adaptation, all the technical work related to understanding adaptation cost, understanding or better plan for adaptation, better recognize efforts of African countries. There's a whole negotiation around that, which is called around the global goal on adaptation, which is really everything related to adaptation and treating adaptation as a comprehensive block. There's that one element. The second piece is on markets. You would recall that already in Katowice, which was before Madrid, we were supposed to finalize the negotiation on the new carbon markets as per the Paris Agreement. Those rules are still being negotiated and were not finalized in Madrid. And rules around transparency on climate finance, meaning having a better understanding and more clarity and disaggregation of the finance information and the finance which is provided north to south. So on all those fronts, a lot of work still. We didn't finalize a number of those pieces. On the finance part, which was also significant, we had some expectation in Madrid to have a very clear understanding of where we were in terms of the 100 billion. And this was already, in 2018, we were not able to get that mandate to have clarity on where we were on the 100 billion. We wanted to have a roadmap already. The African group wanted to have a roadmap on the new goal, which has to be set by 2025. This is a new goal on finance. So it's a new figure, which is going to replace the 100 billion. On none of those, we are not able to make any progress on none of those even. Well, it's true. We are in 2021 now. In 2018, you had a different, this was a different world. You had a different U.S. administration. The U.S. was not in the Paris Agreement then. Now you have a new administration, very much in the Paris Agreement, very much pro-climate. And so the situation has still, but frankly, Madrid was a disappointing COP for the African group, and I think for developing countries by and large.
Despite the disappointment, was there, I remember there was a win on gender. Expand that for us.
Yes, you would recall again that in Paris, it was made very clear that gender would be a strong focus and will be not just a sideshow, but frankly integrated in climate action and climate action from all sides, whether mitigation, adaptation, or even in climate finance, and even in terms of the participation to the meetings. And finally, we were able to adopt in a concrete action plan to advance that. So this is not a small feat. It's really giving, if you want, teeth into the agreement and having concrete activities to integrate gender in our work.
Sini, what has happened between Madrid and now and COP26?
A lot has happened. Take one, for instance. The US has joined the Paris Agreement, and you would know that the US was instrumental in having an agreement in Paris, in that agreement being ratified and entered into force just a year, which is historical. So having the US was the most important country in terms of providing climate finance, in terms of historical responsibility and on the quantum of emissions. So having that country back, and not just back, but back in the leading position where climate plays now a central role in the US, in the Biden administration, this is a very strong, important development. Mm-hmm. The second strong development, fortunately or unfortunately, is of course the COVID reality. Yeah. COVID, we're going into a COP now, which is a very hybrid COP where there is, we are in the midst of a pandemic. But at the same time, what we have learned from COVID, which was very important to us and to our partners, is that money is not an issue. The developed world has spent more than a dozen trillions. I'm not talking billions, a dozen trillions, which is 12,000 billions in propping the economies, in making the economies resilient. So what is sure now is that there's no shortage of money. Before COVID, we were still, in conversation, in negotiation with our colleagues, this idea, well, public resources are scarce. We need to manage we need to mobilize private finance because we don't have enough public finance. That all argument has gone out of the window.
Yeah.
In Japan, in Europe, in US, they've literally printed thousands of billions to rescue their economy. So now, if we are serious, if our partners are serious about climate change, their money, resources, finance, technology should be made available. That argument of, well, there's not enough public resources doesn't hold anymore. This is also a fundamental change. And this has prompted the African ministers, when they met 2-3 weeks ago in Senegal, to really have as a minimum threshold at least $1.3 trillion as a start in the next negotiation on finance. So we are now also starting as Africa to have a better understanding of what resources we need for adequate climate action, whether mitigation or adaptation. This is the second cycle of NDCs. You were asking what has changed. Well, African countries, most of them, have submitted their second round of NDCs, of commitments, climate commitments. So we have a better understanding now as to what we need for mitigation, what we need for adaptation. We have more figures, more quantitative elements and data to deal with that. So those are but three elements. I could also speak about the Green Climate Fund, which has been replenished. And Africa is getting about one third of those resources, with definitely need to do more. I could talk about the Africa Adaptation Initiative and some of the work that we've been doing in the last 2-3 years to really enhance implementation on the ground, whether through climate finance readiness or just working with countries to access more, to access the climate finance which is available. It might be inadequate in terms of quantum and in terms of accessibility, but starting to help and assist countries to access the finance.
Does it mean that now it's very clear that the availability of funds is not the problem? But when we're looking into a report that was published in Nature 3 days ago, looks into says very clearly that the 12-year Copenhagen $100 billion promised is not yet in. And we saw the UN Secretary General. Yes, I can hear
sorry
you.
Sorry to interrupt. No, sorry mm-hmm. to interrupt. Don't get me mm-hmm. wrong. I mm-hmm. said that there's no shortage of money per se. So in absolute, that doesn't mean, and I agree, the 100 billion, they're not there. The OECD, which is the group of, which is the organization where all those developed parties are member, made a report a few weeks ago. You know, you're quoting that one. I'm quoting the OECD report,
which
gives a figure, you know, which is 79.6 billion. This is where uh-huh. they are. They are at 79.6 billion. So we uh-huh. are nowhere near the 100 billion. Some of the arguments that we heard is that, well, the US was not in the Paris Agreement for 4 years. When you know that the US is, you know, historically, the US has been providing 1/3 of the total of what developed countries provide. Mm-hmm. And the US climate finance before the Biden administration was about 5.4, like, let's say, well, ballpark figure, $6 billion a year. Okay.
Yeah.
So Biden came and he doubled that to almost 11.4 to 12 billion. Well, civil society, African countries and others think that the US should go to at least 30 billion. So this administration should go at least to 30 billion before the end. And I'm sure that there is possibility and there's political will. You know, we've seen the US really doubling twice. They doubled first in April when President Biden organized his climate summit, and he doubled it again at the UN General Assembly just a few weeks ago. So we believe that the US has the resources and the political will and should go to the maximum, which is at least 30 billion. If that happens in the next few years, then we can be there. So I'm making the difference between actually the three parts to that conversation. The first part is there's no shortage of money per se,
mm-hmm.
meaning if developed countries want tomorrow to make available 1 trillion, meaning 1,000 billion of dollars, it is possible because frankly, they'll just need to just print it. So that's one thing. Second, we're not at the 100 billion yet. It's 79.6. But they can ramp up now that the US is back in the agreement. This can be ramped up very quickly. Now, third is accessing the resources which are there. And that
one,
oh my God, that one needs a lot of work. I mean, accessing climate, we've done some work to identify why, what are the barriers and what are the challenges to access climate finance. And in our work, we have discovered that there are three fundamental barriers. One is formulating projects and proposals. Second is mobilizing resources, because in many cases you need to be able to blend public, private, domestic and international resources. And the third is execution. And in all those three areas, there's a lot of work for us as African countries to do.
Absolutely. Access of finance has been a big issue. But also, Sidi, there's also another issue, because the 100 billion per year was actually promised, but then again, it was not delivered. The question I was going to ask you is that as we move towards a post-2020 finance roadmap, how does African team, how do you expect, with the knowledge that now it's available out there, that there's no lack of finances, how do you intend to push for just not pledges, but making sure that this money is actually made available? As much as African countries and different African countries have a problem with access, but how do we make sure that this money, these pledges, are not just pledges, they are money that are delivered, whatever that the developed country says in a year they're going to deliver?
Well, the way the group is looking at it is that, first of all, what we want to do to ensure that this negotiation is really different and sort of build back and learn from what has happened in the 100 billion is to have, you see, when the 100 billion pledge was made or pledge commitment was made, there was no technical work, meaning developed countries in that particular case, it was first of all Minister Gordon Brown and then Hillary Clinton, who just announced 100 billion, a round figure.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
we want to have right now is a two-step approach. I mean, the first step, which is technical work, which is going to be not just all the 197 countries together, but representatives, like technical experts. And we did that in 2011 in the creation of the Green Climate Fund. 40 experts, high-level experts, work for a whole year together and produce a governing instrument. And then that governing instrument was tabled and negotiated at COP. We want something similar. So I have a technical group. The technical group will do quantitative assessment of not only what is needed, but also where the money could be mobilized from. And then third, having then an accountability transparency mechanism to ensure that the money which is pledged is sort of committed, it is disbursed, it is received, hopefully mainly through national entities. And this is all done in an efficient manner.
Shouldn't that technical team would have made some work in terms of understanding what exactly does Africa need, actually, that you can use it for negotiations to push for the post-2020 finance?
In terms of individual countries, this is the second cycle of NDCs. So there was already 2 years ago, for instance, on adaptation, the AFDB, the African Development Bank, did an aggregation of all the adaptation priorities of Africa as presented by African countries in their national adaptation plans, in their adaptation, the adaptation component of their contribution, to say this is how much Africa needs. And they did it in a very, you know, in a sectoral manner, in a regional manner. So as I said, we have a lot more quantitative inputs on our elements, on our needs right now than 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. So we have already started to prepare, to aggregate and to compile those information, getting ready to sort of bring that information to the table. And as I said, that group is going to be pre-commitment, meaning doing that quantitative assessment of the needs and the, and where the resources could be mobilized. But even when the figure is going to be adopted or the goal is going to be adopted, we want to have a technical body which is going to ensure that what has been pledged is being disbursed, but it's also being disbursed in a manner which is in accordance with developing countries and African needs.
Apart from finance, there are other critical issues that are critical for actually for African continent. What are those issues?
Well, as I mentioned, adaptation, the reality for what we are seeing right now on the continent is the adaptation costs are already dire. Again, AFDB came up with AFDB did a study on that. African countries are already paying anywhere from 3 to 5% of their GDP per year on climate impact cost already. They're already seeing that, and in some cases it can be devastating. You know, we've all seen the extreme weather events in Mozambique, in Zambia. We're seeing floods in the Sahel, in the Sahara. We're seeing more heat waves. We're seeing locust invasion. I mean, the, Africa has to adapt right now. And that adaptation is going to be more and more important in the future. Mm-hmm. We advocated in the Paris Agreement for what we call a global goal on adaptation, which is a comprehensive undertaking for adaptation. Because before the Paris Agreement, adaptation used to be like the orphan child of, you know, you had mitigation, frankly, in the center, but adaptation was almost the orphan child in the process. So right now, we want very serious work to start, to be launched actually at COP26, which will do those things which I mentioned. First, to sort of have a better understanding of the cost, and not just the cost right now, and the cost in the future based on different temperature scenarios, because adapting to a 2-degree world is not the same thing than adapting to a 2.5 or a 3-degree world. So that's first, understanding of cost. Second, we need to have better instruments to integrate adaptation in the national development planning processes, whether for sectors or whether for region and at the local level. Third, there's a need to recognize that African countries and developing countries are already spending a lot of their fiscal, a lot of their own domestic resources into adaptation. So when we say, well, that we have to be supported by our partners, the reality is that Africa probably is paying, in terms of adaptation cost, we are paying probably now 50, 60, 70, 80% of the cost right now. And this is not being recognized, because sometimes we ask, well, we are being portrayed as, well, we are begging or we are asking for money. Or we, no, this is not charity. Climate change, developed countries are responding to their historical responsibility, it's a commitment It's not charity. It's not aid. They're paying climate finance because they have recognized that they have a historical responsibility in having created that problem. And we are paying the price with our own resources. The fourth point beyond the recognition of the effort is then trying to see how do we close this gap? How do we close the knowledge gap? How do we close the funding gap? How do we close institutional gap? This is through international cooperation, whether South-South, North-South, Pan-African. So those we want to then launch this work, which is really going to tackle adaptation in a very meaningful manner, in a very substantive manner. This is as important to us. This is a very important objective for us at this COP.
And that also speaks in terms of loss and damage, because there's a lot of cost that actually comes as a result of the impact, and that historically African countries and many poor nations have not been responsible for that. But how do developing nations force a decision on loss and damage, making sure that who pays for this loss separate from the normal adaptation funds, from the normal mitigation funds?
Well, that one has been and is still a very controversial negotiation, simply because the price tag to some of those figures could be limitless or infinite. I mean, in the case of, for instance, the loss of islands, literally, I mean, some islands will disappear, whether this is in 20, in 30 or 40 years. How do you compensate a nation which loses its land? I mean, not just its land, but the whole land, because, you know, the whole premise around a nation state is on a territory, right? It's on a land. So when that land disappears, how do you compensate that? Legally, financially? I mean, because of that staggering cost and really the liability, which are infinite, our partners have been extremely reluctant to even start a conversation on how this could be handled, because some fear but then they will be taken to court, and then they would have to literally commit trillions, not really billions, but trillions in terms of compensating those countries. So it has been a very controversial negotiation.
But before I let you, I just want you to talk about the Article 6 on carbon markets, basically. I remember in Madrid, Africa was pushing for part of the carbon market money to go to adaptation funds. And just walk us through what is Africa's position when it comes to carbon markets.
Okay, so to make it plain and simple, historically, at least in the Kyoto Protocol, which was the agreement before Paris, there was on every ton of carbon which was sold through that agreement, there was a levy. It was actually a levy which would then, you know, be used as a resource to fund the adaptation fund. So we have historically mitigation or carbon markets finance adaptation. So from that principle based that historical reality, Africa has kept that principle to say, well, in the future, regardless of the carbon market scheme that we have, we must have a levy to fund adaptation, because the reality is adaptation is poorly funded, right? So that's a principle based. And that one is getting a lot of opposition or resistance, because there's two negotiations in the carbon market. Right? There's a negotiation for the system which will replace the CDM, I mean, the Clean Development Mechanism. What, you know, when people say carbon market, they actually talk about that carbon markets under the UN. This is the one, and that this is the one scheme which is funding the adaptation cost, the adaptation fund. What we are saying is that regardless of the scheme, whether the 2.0 UN scheme for carbon or whether other new carbon schemes, they all have to fund adaptation. So our partners are not agreeing with us on this one, and we're holding firm. That's the first tenet, basically. The second is on the rules. What we did in the past sometimes was to be to create flexibility on rules for different countries. So, and I'm not going to name any country per se, but we allow for rules to be a bit soft and loose to sort of fit some countries' national circumstances. What we are saying now, but we cannot allow ourselves for that. But the rules have to be as stringent as possible, because frankly, we already have very inadequate mitigation pledges. So we cannot add on those inadequate pledges accounting loopholes, because a ton is a ton is a ton. We must really count what the universe sees. And we cannot, it's not even the financial implication, because it has more than financial implication. This is a matter of life and death for many, if not for us all, at some, you know, at a final point. So we cannot be loose with rules. So we, the African group, is actually being extremely stringent on rules to sort of promote environmental integrity. And in the past, we would have, let's say, developing countries, we would have been a bit flexible with rules, provided that that will translate into some financial gains. So our position has changed totally. So those are the two basic tenets of our position, meaning very strong and stringent rules to ensure environmental integrity so that there's no loopholes. And then second, that all mechanisms, whether they're under the UN or not under the UN, must have a levy to finance adaptation. And we can discuss now the percentage, or we can discuss the modality, but in principle, there needs to be a levy to fund adaptation.
Fantastic. Sadie, I have three questions that I wanted you to address.
Yes,
and I can see our time is so much spent, but I still wanted to answer these questions. And one of them is from Jameson, coming from Malawi. And he's asking, we are just 1 week away from the COP. And one of the things that is happening within the continent or within the global south is that majority of delegates are finding it very hard to be able to travel to Glasgow, basically because of COVID restrictions, financial restrictions as well. And of course, some of them have found very many difficulties in terms of accessing badges and invites as well. So he's asking, at this particular time where very few delegates will probably manage to get to Glasgow, how do you make sure that the African voice is loud and clear and not shut down by, you know, governments and lobbyists?
This is a very good question. It's how would I say it? It's a bit of a conundrum, because we in Africa, and we were very clear that there's no way that we can have a virtual negotiation. That the only way for us to come to any agreement is to have a face-to-face negotiation. We were very clear. And we are living in this COVID reality.
Sure.
So indeed, it's a challenge to ensure universal participation. And in Africa, we do negotiate. We are the only one. We're the only region which negotiate as a bloc. The European Union is 27, but not all European nations are in the European Union. So we are 54. So it has its advantages and disadvantages, being 54. Of course, smaller delegations will make it to COP. What the African group has done over the years is that, the African group is probably, I would say, at least 500 or so negotiators, I would imagine, at least 500 or so negotiators. Out of those 500 or so negotiators, about 50 perhaps are the lead negotiators. Those are the ones who would take the mic and speak on behalf of Africa. So what we have done as a group is to ensure that small group, those 50, each one is there. And through electronic communication, each one of the lead coordinator has a coordination group, you see. Small example, we have actually two adaptation negotiators, and they're two ladies, one from Egypt, one from Ghana. But each one of them, have also maybe 20, 30, 40 negotiators to sort of support her in leading the work. Fortunately, through electronic means, WhatsApp and what have you, we can sort of still be able to engage. But it's going to be a challenge. It is a challenge. I'm on my way to Glasgow, and it is a challenge. So I spent probably 5-6 hours filling forms, and it is a challenge. But we have been prepared. There was no COP last year. We have been prepared. We have done a lot of work, and we're coming, as lead negotiators, lead coordinators, we're coming prepared. And as I indicated, we are working with the colleagues who are back home. All the meetings we're having now are hybrid meetings. For instance, right now, the lead coordinators are meeting in Glasgow, in situ. But at the same time, the meeting is also webcast. So the other colleagues who couldn't join are going to be there. And we'll keep such a hybrid form until the very end. But it is a challenge, true. It is a challenge. Hopefully next year, when the COP will be in Africa, everybody will be able to attend. But it is a challenge.
And now goes to the second question. And we have a question from Dr. Mahmoud Bambasila from the African Institute for Mathematics Sciences in Rwanda. He's asking, how does the African Group of Negotiation harness expertise, scientific expertise from Africa, you know, in Africa for the negotiations? So he's asking, where do you get your climate information from? How do you know how the climate affects Africa? What are the facts that you have as a group? Uh-huh. How do you intend to use that for the negotiation? Yeah,
that's a very good question. The fact is that the group is composed of 54 national focal points. So those national focal points are usually at the ministries of environment and the Met offices. So basically we benefit from all the resources of our members. So for instance, you know, South Africa, so the focal point is in the Ministry of Environment. But we're working, you know, in the group, we're working with the University of Cape Town. There are a number of professors in the University of Cape Town. There's the CSR, the South African Science and Industrial Council, Research Council, we work with. We work with African Union related organization, regional economic communities. But we build on, you know, on our membership. You know, this is a multilateral intergovernmental negotiation. So all the institutes, so in the case of Rwanda, the national focal point is at the EPA. We work with the EPA, we work with the fund. It's good that the professor mentioned the institute. And we're also open, we're very open to receiving inputs. But it's as simple as when a specific negotiation starts, we go to whatever African institutions where we have to go to get the information. And I must also add that the composition of the group is also very diverse. As much as the national focal points sort of, they adopt the African common positions, but the lead negotiators themselves are technicians and experts coming from all sorts of backgrounds. You have consultants, you have legal people, you have lawyers, you have university professors. Many of our lead negotiators may not actually be from the Ministry of Environment, and very few are actually even national focal points. Usually our lead negotiators are experts in the field in which they negotiate, or lead diplomats who actually work with their negotiation group, and in their negotiation group they have all kinds of experts. So for instance, if the professor is following a specific negotiation and he would be interested in sort of providing input of the institute, I'll be more than happy to support that. But we do reach out to African institutions, to African expertise, whatever it is in the diaspora or on the continent, to be able to, I mean, to ensure that when we negotiate, we do negotiate from knowledge, from science and the rule of law.
Absolutely. And so experts like him from the continent who probably would want to, because probably there are more than Dr. Bambasila who would want his institution to actually make inputs in terms of the negotiations. But in case anybody else or any other institution within the continent would want to contribute, how would they in terms of reach out to the African Group of Negotiators?
Well, we have a website. Please do share the website. And colleagues can also go on our website to sort of get acquainted of, you know, with the work. And by all means, you know, send us a message. And what we will definitely do is to link you, you know, regardless of the specificity. Actually, the more specific your request, the more specific will be also to guide you and pinpoint to, let's say, a specific lead negotiator. I do that almost on a daily basis. So, for instance, I receive a lot of requests as a spokesperson to, you know, to speak to the lead negotiator on markets. And I do direct colleagues or I do direct the request that, or sometimes request to gender, or depending on, you know, we have about 50 or so themes which are being negotiated, from finance to legal matters to adaptation, agriculture, mitigation, transparency systems in mitigation, transparency reporting in finance. So the more specific requests, the more specific your request, the more I'll be able to direct it to the person who is most adequate or who is leading that negotiation for the continent.
Okay, and that means.
But the entry point should be the website. The entry point should be the website.
The website, absolutely. So I'm going to share that website on our website.
Please do.
So if you're listening, so you scroll back and on our website, Africa Climate Conversations, you'll find the African Group of Negotiators website there. And Ambassador Sini, I'm sure if anybody reaches out to Africa Climate Conversations, we can be able to share your email
please
and
do.
Put you to
yes,
in please contact,
do. Yes,
right?
You can exactly. You can share my email and I'll just forward it to the relevant colleague. Or I will forward it to the assistant of the chair, and we will definitely do that.
Fantastic. And so, to the very final question. So, when I was earlier telling you that we actually earlier on had a conversation with Kamara, he's talking about the position in terms of understanding basically the special needs and circumstances of African continent, and Moses is actually asking, given that LDCs were basically the most opposing, or some of the opposing groups to the Africa special needs and circumstances in Madrid, have you as AGN reached out or achieved a common voice on this matter between the all African delegates, be it they are under Africa or be it they are under LDCs in terms, or do we see the same outcome as, or you know, push and pull as in Madrid?
Well, this is a very serious question and matter. You know, ideally there shouldn't be any controversy or even any major difference or any difference at all between African countries, regardless if they're LDCs or not, right?
Yeah.
So, but the fact that, of course, but the fact that you have LDCs beyond Africa makes it a bit of a challenge, really. What we've done since Madrid, and that we'll continue and work really closely on, is political coordination. The reality is that the next LDC chair is going to be African. You know that right now the chair is from Bhutan, I believe. And the next LDC chair is going to be an African chair. So this is a great opportunity at the highest political level, because this is becoming now a very political, I mean, Africa's special circumstance is a very political, or ensuring our special circumstances are recognized and acknowledged. It's a very political issue. And we're going into an African COP next year. And we want that African COP to be the, at the latest, we want this to be addressed and finalized there. So we have reached out to the to our principals, our political principals, and sort of ensure that this is taken at that level, but this is taken at ministerial, even heads of state level, so that we don't have a situation where we could even be seen as African countries contradicting each other or African. This is not good for, you know, we shouldn't be in that position. So that's how we are addressing it, in a political manner, because at the technical point, I think the argument has been made and it has been articulated in a very, hopefully in a very, I mean, I think in a very convincing manner. I mean, we've done, we compiled information and inputs from most African institutions, the African Union, the African Union Economic Commission on Africa, the AFDB and others, to really demonstrate Africa's socioeconomic vulnerability beyond and above climate change. So the technical work has been done, but we realize that maybe now the political work is what needs to be. We have not spent meaningful time and on the political and the diplomatic work which needs to happen at that political level. You know, we have informed and we're working now with the political level to ensure that this is done, definitely at this COP, but going into the African COP. And as I said, it's going to be an African country which will chair the LDC group. So this is most opportune, going as well into an African COP. So the stars are aligning, and we really must make the best use of that alignment to ensure that Africa is safe.
Absolutely.
And it's a very sensitive question, and you know I myself I'm a Malian, and Somalia is an LDC country. So there's, you know, and Africa, and we you graduate, as we like to say, we will all graduate one day from the LDC, but you'll never graduate from Africa.
Sure.
So at the end of the day Africa is the one who keeps us all safe, not any other, you know, group which has been composed or constituted on economic or that very economic economic basis. And the good thing is, the good thing is that the political level understand that totally, and the political level is aligned. And actually, our political principles, they all would have wanted to be out of the LDCs 10 years ago. So it's really, I mean, convincing them, it has been very easy for us to present the argument and to say that, well, there's this issue and we have proposed ways to address it. Of course, in a political and a diplomatic manner, because as I indicated, you have non-African LDCs, and the way it's not to say, well, that their concerns are not going to be taken into account. But at the right political level, ministers, not just ministers of environment, even ministers of foreign affairs, they can really pursue that conversation and make sure that we have an outcome which benefits all developing countries, by the way. This was our position, to say we are willing to work with all developing countries in recognizing and acknowledging their special circumstances, and make ways for that and make provisions for that. So this is not actually, we're not asking anyone to just support Africa and left themselves behind. The position we are adopting is, you know, no developing country left behind.
Yeah. So, all right, Sini. We've really gone so overboard in terms of time, but I just want to hear from you as a final word. What would be the ideal outcome for Africa be at Glasgow?
Wow, what would be the ideal outcome? Well, some of the few outcomes would be on adaptation. I told you about this comprehensive work program to be adopted. Mm-hmm. On finance, the roadmap that I had indicated, you know, which would have that very strong technical work and then a political process where we will agree on a goal, and then we'll have a standing technical body to really ensure that the pledges and the commitment are disbursed and in a transparent manner. This negotiation has to pass. On the 100 billion, as I said, as the OECD said, we are at 79.6 billion. There need to be now a clear commitment and a timetable as to when the 100 billion is going to be there, accessible and disbursed. The special circumstance on Africa, we need to have a dedicated space and time bound to finalize it, which would be, to me, latest next year. And then a lot more an increase in ambition. And it's frankly, I mean, the COP26 starts with a summit of heads of state, a leader summit on the first and the second. What we need a serious ramp up of ambition, mitigation ambition, finance ambition. So I hope that those leaders traveling to Glasgow will come with additional ambition on finance, on mitigation, so that we really start the COP on a very high momentum. Mm. The nature of Article 6 conversation is so technical. Our position is known. We as Africa, if we don't have stringent rules, we will not compromise the rules. We will not have for us, no outcome is better than an outcome which will prejudice the environmental integrity of the system. Meaning, if a few developed countries or one or two developed countries are telling us, well, that they can't join because these rules will make it impossible for them to count their forestry, well, we'll tell them, well, that's fine, then no agreement. So on the markets, our positions are the integrity, we're not going to negotiate the integrity of the system. Okay. And on the levy, it's too, you know, our position right now is no, we need to have a process of that levy. If that is not going to happen, well, how are we going to fund adaptation? On loss and damage, mm-hmm. what we are working towards on adaptation right now, which is that very comprehensive work program. And I think the colleagues who are going to come after me, the colleagues on loss and damage, will articulate mm-hmm. some of the key elements that we need to sort of have this substantive work program as well on loss and damage. That's where mm-hmm. we need to be. And we have to also pass that one.
Thank you so much, Sini. We have to end it there. And I hope to...
Thank you, Sophie.
and I hope to actually find some more time to basically discuss the adaptation initiative and also look into what we achieve at Glasgow.
I'll be happy to come and report, hopefully, with the good news.
Yeah.
Okay, with more. Yeah, I'll be happy to come. But on a serious note, I'll be happy to come and report the outcome and also hopefully the next steps going into COP27, because we've already frankly started working on COP27 to ensure that we have a substantive thing that, so I'll be happy to also present some of our early thoughts on that one when we talk at the end. I look forward to work with the Institute of Mathematics. I really heard good feedback on that institute, and I'll be very happy to work with the institute. Please note our interest.
Yeah, I hope Dr. Bambasila is listening, and I've heard that, and we'll actually get in touch.
Asante sana.
And that was Abassanda Seinina for the AGN spokesperson, giving us the overview of issues Africa will be pushing at Glasgow. Please remember to subscribe to the Africa Climate Conversations podcast, as we will be bringing you timely updates on Africa at Glasgow for the entire period. Please send us questions, comments, observations using info@africaclimateconversations.com. And please remember, you can find us on Google, Spotify, iTunes, Anchor, every other podcast channel, and we will soon be on YouTube. I will see you next week on Tuesday, but until then, have a lovely week. Kwaheri. My name is Sophie Mbogo.